General Colin Powell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Defense Secretary Dick Cheney were in the group that filled the upstairs hall after they finished their briefing with the President. I had just come out of our room. "Billy, you show them down at that end," the President said to me, "and I will take them up at this end." So I took about a third of them to the Queen's bedroom and the Lincoln bedroom, checking to make sure Ruth was concealed, and tried to give them a guided tour, telling them what little I knew from my several visits there. At his inauguration in 1989, he invited me to lead the various prayers during the public ceremony. I protested at first, pointing out that it was customary to have clergy from other traditions participate also. He remained adamant, however, saying he felt more comfortable with me. Besides, he added, he did not want people to think he was just trying to play politics by having representatives of different faiths. When the inauguration was over, we were taken, to my surprise, to the President's box in the reviewing stand to watch the inaugural parade. During a break in the parade, the President motioned for me to come to him. "Billy, would you and Ruth mind going back to the White House and seeing my mother? She is up there watching the parade, and I know she would just love to have you with her." I said we would be delighted. Around 90 and in very frail health, Mrs. Bush had been flown in for the event in an ambulance plane with a doctor and a nurse. She was in the Queen's bedroom, propped up in bed, her eyes as blue as indigo and her face aglow. She looked like a queen herself, in spite of her fragility. I sat there and held her hand for a few minutes, then asked if I could pray. She nodded with a smile, and I said a few sentences of thanksgiving to God that in His grace George Bush was now president, and I asked the Lord to lead, guide, and protect him in the years ahead. When I was finished and looked back toward her, she had tears in her eyes and spoke in a whisper, "He will need it." Shortly afterward, I called him Mr. President for the first time instead of George. It was an awkward moment, and I stumbled a bit. He knew my dilemma since many of his other friends felt the same way. He looked a bit wistful, and his gaze went to the far distance. No matter how much a president might wish it otherwise, there was a loneliness to that office that could never be completely overcome. That loneliness is one of the burdens of leadership. Since the Bushes left the White House, they've invited us to get together several times, in Houston or Kennebunkport, just to visit. Whenever possible, we've done so. We've exchanged notes and talked on the telephone. "Thanks for checking in," he often says. I'll never forget how proud the Bushes were of their son George at his inauguration as governor of Texas in January 1995. I had been asked to lead the inaugural prayer, and as I did, I was reminded once again not only of the Bushes' strong family ties, but also of their strong commitment to public service, a commitment that they have passed on to the next generation. All our married life, Ruth has talked about China, and with good reason. Growing up in China gave Ruth a love for the Chinese people and their culture that has never left her. China is the world's oldest continuous civilization. I read somewhere that the Chinese invented or discovered half the objects upon which the modern world rests. Sometimes I think Ruth eats, sleeps, and breathes China. She's taught me to love China, too, including its food. At least once or twice a week, she fixes us simple but authentic Chinese dishes. She's even succeeded in teaching me to use chopsticks with a fair degree of proficiency. For many years, Ruth's greatest desire was to return to the land of her birth and to take me with her. She wanted to show me the places she loved and introduce me to some of the people she knew. She even prayed that it would be possible for me to preach in China. But if ever a dream seemed impossible, this was it. Ruth left China in 1933 to attend high school at the Pyongyang Foreign School in Pyongyang, now Pyongyang, North Korea. After high school in 1937, she came to the United States, where she enrolled at Wheaton College. In 1941, the Bells were finally forced to leave China because of the Japanese occupation. Ruth could return no more. The Chinese communist victory under Mao Zedong in 1949 and the virulently anti-religious policies of the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and the 1970s seemed to nail the door permanently shut. The collapse of the Cultural Revolution under Chairman Mao's death in 1976 and the establishment of diplomatic relations between the United States and the People's Republic of China in 1979 marked the beginning of a new era. However, the guiding political philosophy in China continued to be a form of communism that had been adapted to the Chinese situation. Atheism was still a part of the official ideology, and religion was not encouraged. By 1979, a few churches were being allowed to reopen, although they were subject to numerous restrictions. In 1980, Ruth and her two sisters, Rosa Bell Montgomery and Virginia Bell Somerville, and their brother, Clayton Bell, journeyed back to the country of their birth for a memorable visit. They found that much had changed in their old hometown of Qingchangpu. "We felt like Rip Van Winkle," Ruth said later. At the time, Qingchangpu was closed to foreigners, but special permission for their visit had been obtained through the good graces of former President Nixon. The 1980 trip was unquestionably one of the highlights of Ruth's life, but it also increased Ruth's determination and prayers for the two of us to visit China. Going as a tourist was no longer difficult, but securing permission for an extended preaching tour was quite another matter. Frankly, for several years I doubted if it would ever be possible. I hoped and prayed right along with Ruth. My interest in China was motivated by much more than just a desire to visit her homeland, though. For one thing, China was now the world's largest nation, with a population of over 1 billion people. Almost one out of every four persons on the planet was Chinese. Furthermore, during China's history, Christianity had made very little impact on that society. It had always been perceived as an alien, exclusively European or white man's religion. Chinese authorities had failed to distinguish between those foreigners who went to China to exploit them and those who went to serve them. And the often sordid history of Western colonialism in China only reinforced their belief that exploitation lay behind anything foreign. What a challenge to a Christian evangelist! Because Ruth was so familiar with the Chinese situation, I asked her to coordinate the investigation and planning for a possible trip. She had already been talking informally with a small group of experts on China. At our request, they became an active working group to assist us. The months prior to our planned visit were as busy as any others in my ministry. Part of the problem was we all knew China was a complex and difficult place. A great deal of care was needed to avoid mistakes or pitfalls that would bring embarrassment to our hosts or discredit to the Christian believers. Our formal invitation came from the China Christian Council, which was officially recognized by the government and also was affiliated with what was known as the Three Self Patriotic Movement. The term refers to China's church's policy of being self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating, and underlines the church's independence from foreign influence and support. The movement had its roots in the thinking of the 19th century American Presbyterian missionary John Livingston Nevius. His ideas were rejected by his co-workers in China, but were eventually adopted by the missionaries in Korea, where the Nevius method was credited with the rapid growth of the Korean church. On the other hand, millions of Chinese Christians worshipped either as single-family units or in so-called house churches, meeting as regularly as possible. These groups of believers were sometimes referred to as meeting-point Christians. Many of the house churches were not affiliated with the officially sanctioned Three Self Patriotic Movement. In many instances, they rejected the leadership of that body and its churches because of their ties to the government. I didn't want to offend either group, but I knew there would be pressure, especially from the Western press, to take sides or even to make some statement opposing the government's policies toward either group. In addition, I knew China could be a political minefield. Although the relations between the United States and China were more cordial than in the past, a number of thorny issues still remained, including human rights. Before our arrival in Beijing, several of our advance crew flew in from Hong Kong. On landing in Beijing, they experienced a fierce dust storm blowing in from the Gobi Desert, which ruined the film crew's plan to shoot scenes around the city before our heavy schedule began. On Tuesday, April 12th, we arrived at the Beijing airport via a stopover in Hong Kong. As we got off the plane, fine dust, almost like talcum powder, still hung in the air and caught in the throat, making speaking without coughing difficult. Ruth remembered such storms from her childhood. How quickly my notions about China and its people, in spite of my briefings, were shattered. In a span of 17 days, covering 2,000 miles and 5 major cities, we packed in more speaking and preaching engagements, interviews, social events, and even sightseeing than I remembered from any other trip I'd ever taken, though not as much sightseeing as I would have liked. Journalist Ed Plowman and photographer Russ Busby chronicled the entire odyssey that evolved into a pictorial book published by the BGEA. We also took a television crew with us to document our trip. Both foreign and American press interviewed us at many stages, but their coverage hardly hinted at the impact all those experiences made on me. Several events, however, remained as special highlights in my memory. One was our visit with Premier Li Peng, who had been chosen as head of state just 2 days earlier by China's parliament, the National People's Congress. His main task was to administer the country's modernization policy. He invited us to visit him on Saturday afternoon, April 16th, at a traditional Chinese-style building called the Pavilion of Lavender Light. It stood in a corner of the ancient walled compound, known in the days of the emperors as the Forbidden City. This is the area in which high-level government officials live today. I was his second foreign visitor, the first having been President Corazon Aquino of the Philippines. I knew Premier Li was somewhat familiar with us, since our visit was preceded by personal notes of introduction from Nixon, Kissinger, and Bush. "Although we have different faiths," the Premier said on greeting me through his interpreter, "that does not matter and will not be any obstacle to our dialogue." I found it interesting that he seemed to be referring to communism as a faith. Our visit with Premier Li had an unexpected side effect. By going public on television, radio, and in the press about our private conversation, the Premier created visibility and credibility for us that we could never have gotten otherwise, and opened many doors for us. In addition, it gave an unusual degree of visibility to the Christians and churches of China I was visiting. In no place we visited was there any restriction on what I could say, and I took advantage of that to expound the gospel to respectful and attentive audiences. Certainly a major highlight was the opportunity to preach in a number of churches, visiting with Christians who were part of the Three Self Patriotic Movement, as well as those involved in the unregistered or house churches. I sensed a tremendous spiritual vitality. When I preached in historic Chung Wen Men Church in Beijing with Hong Kong Seminary President Philip Cheng as my interpreter, 1,500 people packed the 700-seat sanctuary. I urged my listeners to include in China's ambitious modernization program a moral and spiritual renewal as well, or a value system, as I explained to Charles Gibson when he interviewed me via satellite from Beijing on the Good Morning America program. Most of all, I urge them to open their hearts to Christ and His transforming power and love. For me personally, the undisputed high spot of the trip was my chance to see Ruth's birthplace in Jingchangpu. It was now part of the larger community of Huaiyin, a metropolitan area made up of several former cities and towns in what is now called Jiangsu Province, with perhaps 250,000 inhabitants. It straddled the Grand Canal, the longest man-made waterway in the world, originally completed in the 13th century, and stretching 1,000 miles from Yangchow to Beijing. A little section of that metropolis, now called Xinjiang, was the old Presbyterian Mission Hospital compound. There Ruth was born and spent her childhood and early teen years. Reminiscences between Ruth and old friends crowded the hours we spent there. I thought of her father and mother, and of Ken and Kay Geezer. The latter couple had befriended Ruth and me in our student days at Wheaton. An eye surgeon in China, he too had been forced to leave by the Japanese. At the local church, 74-year-old pastor Fei Su, who had been there since 1936, told us that as many as 800 attended Sunday services now in the old missionary house of Jim and Sophie Graham, spilling out into the yard. When Ruth saw the house in 1980, it was a wholesale grocery outlet, the former living room decorated by a picture of Chairman Mao. Now many of the partitions had been removed to provide room for the Christian worshipers. Pastor Fei estimated there were 130,000 Christians in that area of the province. One church member told how the pastor had spent some years in prison during the Cultural Revolution. Like Pastor Fei, a lot of Chinese clergy were getting old. It was remarkable they had survived so long. But with growth both in the number of churches and in the attendance at services, new leaders were urgently needed. The 12 seminaries in China had only 600 students enrolled, I was told, hardly adequate for future staffing of the thousands of pulpits. Since that memorable trip in 1988, I've returned to China twice, in both instances stopping over for a few days in Beijing before going on to North Korea. Both times, 1992-1994, I've been staggered by China's explosive economic growth, with massive traffic jams and skyscrapers under construction. On each visit, my feeling about China's strategic place in the future has been reinforced. We continue to pray for China, that it may become a spiritual powerhouse in the future. It gives Ruth and me special joy that our younger son, Ned, has become deeply committed to China. He now heads a small organization based in the Seattle area called East Gates Ministries International, devoted to assisting the church in China through training, literature, and Bible distribution. As I write this, East Gates has been given official permission to print several million Bibles at the Amity Printing Press in Nanjing, a joint project of the China Christian Council and the United Bible Societies. These are earmarked for legal distribution to house churches throughout China, groups that have had no reliable legal source of Bibles in the past. God is still at work in the ancient land of China, and for that we rejoice. Although people who are constantly in the public eye usually learn to shield their inner thoughts, they have the same personal problems and questions that we do. Sometimes such people have felt free to talk intimately with me, knowing that I would hold their remarks in confidence. I never go to see important people or anyone else without having the deep realization that I am, first and foremost, an ambassador of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I first met Bill Clinton while he was governor of Arkansas. I'd been invited to speak at the 1985 National Governors Conference in Boise, Idaho, and he sought me out to ask if we could spend some time together. We went out on the lawn and talked for a couple of hours. His quick mind and his warm personality impressed me immediately. We met again during our September 1989 crusade in Little Rock. A day or two later, Hillary telephoned me to ask if we could have lunch and talk. "I would be delighted to," I replied, "but I don't have private luncheons with beautiful ladies." "We could go and sit in the middle of the dining room at the Capitol Hotel where everybody will be able to see us," she said, "and still have a private conversation." Which we did. I didn't know much about Mrs. Clinton before that meeting, except that she was a lawyer. She impressed me as a genuine intellectual as we talked. she moved knowledgeably from some government project or political issue to a family or personal matter and back again. I left our luncheon greatly impressed by her. Governor Clinton was honorary chair of that Little Rock crusade. He and Hillary gave a luncheon for us, with a few of the crusade's strongest supporters and leaders of the state invited too, including former Governor Orville Faubus. During that time, Clinton asked me a favor. My pastor is dying of cancer. He lives several miles from here. I would like to drive you to his home, and we can read the Bible to him and pray with him and encourage him. He has meant a lot to me. His pastor turned out to be one of the leading evangelical pastors in the Southern Baptist Convention, Dr. W. O. Vaught, who had played a pivotal part in getting us to come to Little Rock and was widely loved and respected. The governor drove me out there, just the two of us. We were greeted by the pastor's wife and taken immediately into his bedroom. He was propped up with pillows and had his Bible open. He was down below 100 pounds, and we all knew his time on earth was short. W.O., I said in greeting, we're certainly praying for you at this time, that if it's God's will, you will be healed. I have something to say to you, boys, said W.O., sit down. And he started in with his Scofield Bible on the second coming of Christ, and the hope of heaven we have as believers in Christ. In spite of his frailty, he gave us a real Bible lesson that lasted 30, perhaps 40 minutes without stopping. Finally, he finished. Now let's have prayer, he said. Let each one of us pray. We will pray for the crusade. So Governor Clinton and I got down on our knees by the bed. The governor prayed first, a wonderful prayer. Then I prayed. Then Pastor Vaught closed. I know both Bill Clinton and I felt that we had received far more encouragement from our visit than we ever could have given to his pastor. Two events from President Clinton's first term in office will always remain in my memory. The first occurred in 1995, shortly after the tragic bombing of the Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City. By any standard, that bombing, which resulted in the death of 168 men, women, and children, and injury to hundreds more, was a senseless, barbaric act. The whole nation was in a state of shock, but no one was touched so deeply as the citizens of Oklahoma City and the state of Oklahoma. The day after the bombing, I received an invitation to participate in a special memorial service for the victims of the disaster from Governor Frank Keating and his wife Kathy. Just a few weeks earlier, she had been taken to our San Juan, Puerto Rico crusade by Laura Bush, wife of Governor George Bush of Texas. Mrs. Keating was coordinating the Oklahoma service. President and Mrs. Clinton came also, and in his simple but deeply moving words, he extended his and his wife's sympathy to those who had suffered the loss of a loved one. By his presence and his speech, he also conveyed to everyone in Oklahoma the clear message that the whole nation was standing with them in their grief. I spoke also to the assembled crowd, one of the most difficult things I've done in my life, telling them frankly that I didn't understand why God allowed things like this to happen. Our knowledge is limited, I pointed out, and there are some things we will never understand this side of eternity. I reminded them, however, that even though we do not understand, God does not change. He is still the God of love and mercy, and in the midst of our sorrow and pain, we can turn to Him in faith and trust. The service itself was unforgettable, but I will always especially remember joining President and Mrs. Clinton as we met privately with some of the families who had been affected by the bombing. There were no television cameras or reporters around, and Mr. Clinton had nothing to gain politically by taking the time to be with them. And yet seldom have I seen anyone express so movingly and sincerely a genuine sense of compassion and sympathy to those who were hurting. I felt that he, not I, was the real pastor of that day. I couldn't help but wonder if his own years of hardship and pain as a child had given him an understanding of the heartache and pain of those who suffer, whatever the cause. The second occasion took place on May 2, 1996, when Ruth and I were presented with the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest honor the Congress of the United States can bestow on a citizen. Our local congressional representative from Western North Carolina, Charles Taylor, had first proposed the idea, without my knowledge, to the congressional leadership. Then he enlisted the support and help of my colleague, T.W. Wilson. The medal itself depicted Ruth and me on one side, with an image on the reverse of the new Ruth and Billy Graham Children's Health Center at Asheville's Memorial Mission Hospital. T.W. had worked with the hospital on the project, and funds from the sale of the bronze copies of the medal went to help provide health care for poor children throughout Appalachia. I felt totally unworthy of the honor which was first given to George Washington in 1776. Ours, we understood, was only the 114th such medal awarded in America's history. And I was delighted that Ruth was included in the honor. For without her partnership and encouragement over the years, my own work would have been impossible. The ceremony itself was held in the Capitol Rotunda, with a number of officials from both parties participating, including Vice President Al Gore, Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, Senate President Pro Tem Strom Thurmond, and our two senators from North Carolina, Jesse Helms and Louch Faircloth. I was especially pleased that many members of our families could be present in the rotunda, including our five children and a number of grandchildren. In his remarks, Bob Dole, who has a terrific sense of humor, quipped, "When the idea of awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to the Grahams was first raised, it received something rare in this building, unanimous approval." On a more serious note, he kindly added that historians would soon be issuing their conclusions about the most influential people of the 20th century, and asserting that any such list will be incomplete if it doesn't include the name of Billy Graham. Statements like that always humble me. If there's any truth in it, it's only that many thousands of people have prayed for our ministry and given financially to make it possible. I replied that Ruth and I were accepting the medal on their behalf also, and that we both felt very unworthy of all the remarks that had been made and of the honor itself. After the award ceremony in the Capitol, Mr. Clinton showed up at the dinner hosted by Memorial Mission Hospital. I hardly ever go to a place as president that Billy Graham had not been there before me preaching, he remarked to the crowd. Then he recalled his boyhood experience of going to our crusade in Little Rock at a time of great racial tension and the impact it made on his life. He also spoke of our visits together across the years. After his remarks, he presented me with a framed copy of the legislative bill that authorized the Congressional Gold Medal for us and the pen with which he had signed it. Afterward, we went backstage, and he gave me a long hug before departing. It was a memorable conclusion to a memorable day. As the 1996 election approached, I faced what by now was a familiar dilemma. Two friends running against each other for the same office. Some people who were strongly in favor of one of the candidates particularly pressed me to come out in support of their candidate, but I steadfastly refused to do so. During the campaign, Elizabeth Dole, whom I had known for many years, attended our Charlotte crusade one evening, and her presence was noted from the platform. Some people took that as an implied endorsement of her husband. On the other hand, my appearances with the president from time to time undoubtedly made other people conclude that by implication I was endorsing him. My own prayer was that God's will would be done, and that he would grant wisdom, compassion, and integrity to whoever was elected to our highest office. That was my prayer also as I stood on the podium on January 20th, 1997, as President Clinton and Vice President Gore were inaugurated to their second term in office. The burdens and responsibilities of that office are enormous, and no person can ever fulfill its demands with his own strength, but only with the grace and help of Almighty God. President Clinton knows the reality of that truth, and as America approaches the dawning of a new century, I pray that all who follow him in that office may know it as well. Because the name of Billy Graham is usually so prominent in the media, many people cannot understand that our ministry has been a team effort. The dedicated men and women working with us have been willing to do anything and everything. More than once I have arrived in a city and gone out to a stadium or arena and found Cliff Barrows, Grady Wilson, Charlie Riggs, or Walter Smith putting chairs in place. Once I discovered one of our senior crusade directors cleaning the toilet in the men's restroom shortly before a service. The central core of our team has been with us almost since the beginning. I'll never be able to repay the debt I owe them for their friendship and their sacrifice over the years. Cliff Barrows, Grady Wilson, Walter Smith, George Wilson, Beverly Shea, Ted Smith, Esther Ladau, Charlie Riggs, Russ Busby, T.W. Wilson, each has been with me for at least 3 decades. In the case of Grady, now gone to be with the Lord, and his brother T.W., the ties reach back to our youth. Many others in the BGEA Association have been with us almost as long. Like Grady, some, such as Willis Haymaker, have gone on to heaven. In order to do whatever needed to be done, they have subordinated their personal privileges, reordered their priorities, accepted disappointments and endless changes in schedule, stretched their patience, absorbed criticism, and exhausted their energy. They were the heaven-sent ones who propped me up when I was sagging, and often protected me from buffetings that would have scared me or scarred me otherwise. They did not back away from correcting me if I needed it, or counseling me with their wisdom when I faced decisions. I'm convinced that without them, burnout would have left me nothing but a charred cinder within 5 years of the 1949 Los Angeles Crusade. The key has been a team, a faithful and gifted staff, that has carried the greatest part of the burden and relieved me of all but the most pressing administrative decisions and duties. An increasingly troublesome issue for us as time went on was how to raise a family in the glare of constant public scrutiny. In the early years of our marriage, it was not a problem, of course. 2 years after Ruth and I left Illinois to live in North Carolina while I was traveling with Youth for Christ, we managed to buy a little house on the Presbyterian Conference grounds of Montreat, 2 miles from the town of Black Mountain. The price of the house was $4,500, and it was located right across the street from Ruth's parents' home. It was really a summer house with a large lot and a little stream. Ruth remodeled it, and it became our dream home. It was also the home where most of our children spent their early childhood. Gigi was born in 1945 while I was away. Having missed Gigi's birth, I was determined to be home during the births of our other children, and I will always be grateful that it was possible. Anne was born in 1948, and Ruth, always known to us as Bunny, in December 1950. When the boys were born, Franklin in 1952, the genuine junior at last, and Ned in 1958, our family was complete. I was even in the delivery room for Ned's birth, an unforgettable experience. Each little personality gave Ruth and me a different joy and a different challenge. But as our ministry expanded and became well known, we began to experience serious problems with keeping our privacy. Several denominational conference centers were located in our area, and from time to time the attendees and other tourists would seek out our home. A few even took chips of wood from the rail fence or picked up pebbles as souvenirs. People meant no harm, I'm sure, but it was disruptive to say the least, and made a normal family life difficult. It became evident that our family needed more privacy, especially with my being gone so much. While I was away, Ruth arranged with Mr. Hickey down at the Black Mountain Northwestern Bank, which already held the mortgage on our present house, to borrow the money to build a new house. In the 40 years since, The place has seen a heap of living and has stood solid through all kinds of storms, internal as well as external. Ruth made it a safe and happy home for the children and a real refuge for me. Our house on the mountain solved the problem of family privacy once and for all. But whenever I leave Montreat, privacy once again becomes a problem. I am recognized almost everywhere, and I am approached constantly. By nature, I am a shy person, and I don't enjoy going out much. But when I do go out, for example to a restaurant, I'm sometimes discovered, often it seems just when the meal has been served. Although hearing testimonies and meeting new people is an honor and encouragement, it does have its drawbacks. A person comes over to shake my hand, and then another one to ask for an autograph, and then another one who wants to share a problem, and so on. A more implacable problem for my family and me, however, was my constant travel. The only answer was to try to make our times together as normal as possible, and to concentrate on my family as much as possible during the times I was home. Nevertheless, as our children grew, the preaching crusades occupied me, at times almost to the exclusion of family claims. This is a difficult subject for me to talk about, but over the years, the BGEA and the team became my second family without my realizing it. Ruth says those of us who were off traveling missed the best part of our lives, enjoying the children as they grew. She is probably right. I was too busy preaching all over the world. Only Ruth and the children can tell what those extended times of separation meant to them. For myself, as I look back, I now know that I came through those years much the poorer, both psychologically and emotionally. I missed so much by not being home to see the children grow and develop. The children must carry scars of those separations, too. Recently, my children have told me that I have probably been too hard on myself. They remember vividly the times of fun we all had when I was at home. I now warn young evangelists not to make the mistakes I did. But Ruth reminds me that the situation is different today. There are many more evangelists and far more Christian programs on television and radio, so perhaps the need for constant travel is less necessary. Given our own family situation, I have only respect and sympathy for the courageous and committed single parents who, for a while or for a lifetime, have to carry the burden alone. The secret of Ruth's survival was in her commitment, not only her marriage commitment before God of her love for me, but also her ministry commitment of the two of us to the Lord's purpose for our lives together. And Ruth will be the first to say that she loved her part, staying home with the children. Our children could not possibly have missed their daddy nearly as much as I missed them and their mother when I was away. I wanted Ruth to be with me as often and as long as possible. I am afraid I sometimes applied a lot of pressure urging her to join me, which only added to her stress. Back at Montreat, whenever I had to leave, we gathered to say goodbye. We held hands and prayed. As I boarded the train, or later the plane, my heart would be heavy, and more than once I drove down the mountain with tears in my eyes. Maybe it was a little easier for the girls. They experienced their mother's constancy and shared so many of her interests. And, of course, Dr. and Mrs. Bell, Ruth's parents, were just across the street and later down the hill. But the boys, with four women in the house, needed their father at home. Coming as the fourth child and my namesake, Franklin especially may have craved my companionship. What I missed, and what Ruth missed by not having me to help her. Whenever I did get home for a short stay between engagements, I would get a crash course in the agony and ecstasy of parenting. If Ruth had not been convinced that God had called her to fulfill that side of our partnership, and had not resorted constantly to God's word for instruction and to His grace for strength, I don't see how she could have survived. Franklin was almost six by the time Ned came along. He was named Nelson after Ruth's father, and Edmund after the president of Wheaton College, who was so beloved by both of us. Ruth thought of his late arrival as a kind of happy P.S. to our family. She had already used up her wedding veil in trimming the old bassinet 4 times, so this newcomer had to make do with a cradle. With 2 boys in the household, my fathering was more urgently needed than ever. Still, sometimes I was away for months at a time. What I did when I was away apparently didn't impress the children much. One time, when the mountain house was being built, I was out in the yard shoveling some dirt from one spot to another. Franklin, watching intently, suddenly piped up and said, "Daddy, you can work." The traveling ministry was a costly investment of my time as far as my sons were concerned. Both of them, like many of their generation in the 60s and 70s, went through severe tests of their faith and standards. I tried to let all 5 of the children know that I loved them, no matter what they did, that I missed them when I was away, that I supported their mother's discipline of them, and that I wanted them to discover God's perfect plan for each of them. Ruth and I were not perfect parents. We tried to discipline the children fairly, but at the same time we tried not to lay down a lot of rules and regulations. When I objected to Franklin's long hair, Ruth reminded me that it wasn't a moral issue, and I kept my mouth shut on that subject thereafter. Actually, as Ruth pointed out with a twinkle in her eye, Franklin was in the tradition of the prophets and apostles. In a radio interview not many years ago, Franklin told about his rebel years of drinking, drugs, smoking, girls, and fast driving. These were things, he said, his mother and I knew nothing about, or so he thought. And he said he never forgot a conversation I had with him in Lausanne, Switzerland, in 1974. I assured him of our love, no matter what he did, where he went, or how he ended up. He knew that he could always phone us collect from anywhere in the world, and that whenever he wanted to come home, the door would always be open. He also knew we would never stop praying for him. It was actually during a trip to the Middle East while in Jerusalem that he made his firm decision to follow Christ. Ned, as the youngest, may have gotten special privileges from us, along with special pestering from his older brother, whom he adored, and from his mothering sisters. He didn't seem as defensive as Franklin, though, and was more happy and outgoing. As with all of our children, Ned eventually went away to boarding school. But his school experience in England was not a happy one. We brought him back home after only 1 year. His teen years, too, were troubled with complications, including drugs, in high school and college. His many enthusiasms included photography, swimming, tennis, and skiing, but studying didn't make the list.